Game On on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
And a very good evening from Damien O'Mara. Welcome to Tuesday's Game On. Busy hour ahead. We were just debating off air a moment ago. What time or at what point does the ongoing questioning of Jack Grealish's international future become a saga or develop into being Grealishgate? It's probably not too far away. His father's been chatting more about his son's future. We will hear from him in a moment. We will chat about international eligibility and Grealish's standing within English football with Brian Kerr and Dominic McGuinness in just a moment. Plenty of Champions League chat ahead of this week's action. Paddy Barnes and Michael Conlon have all qualified for the Rio Olympic Games. They will be guests on the programme in or around 7:30, and much more to come as well. 51552 is the text number. You can tweet us this Tuesday evening at GameOn2FM. I promised you last night that Hugh Cahill would be back. I've let you down in that regard. He'll be back tomorrow, but to make up for it, we've got two of the all-time greats in studio. Gary Murphy with us, as he is on so many occasions. How are you?
Very well, Damien.
And a man who knows all about granny rules and international eligibility and everything else. Brian Kerr, how are you?
I'm great. And a bit of a legend in my own garden.
I think you're a legend. You know, I won't hear a bad word said about you. We'll talk about Grealish in a moment, but on boxing, you were up before your breakfast over the weekend to see the lads qualify for the Rio Games.
Well, I didn't see them because it was I couldn't find her anywhere. But when I saw the results and the fact that they qualified for the Olympics, I was deliriously happy. I just think it's amazing that the two of them have qualified through such a hard road, seven away fights, and to have made it so early and be able to plan and scheme and not be dangling through the World Championships or the European Championships and dodgy decisions and making the weight and all the other problems that can come up and stop a fella making it to the Olympic Games. You know, as Billy Walsh pointed out, there was two Olympic Games where we only had one boxer qualified. Now we've got two qualified well in advance, 15 or 16 months in advance, and two great potential medalists, because such a hard road. And you know, I was privileged to be in London and see them winning medals last time out.
Is it the sport, or are they the sports people, boxers, that you've got the most respect for?
The boxers,
yeah.
The sport is split up into so many divisions now with these new categories, and it seems to be semi-pro, and they're fighting 5 3-minute rounds, and some bits of it there seems to be head guards, others there's no head guards, and now it seems to be getting abandoned altogether, the head guard rule. So it's a changing sport, and the trying to find some ground between professionalism and amateurism is probably going to find time for all to even out. But it's my admiration of the dedication of the amateur boxers for so little return and so little recognition. There's a bit of a flurry in Ireland every 4 years when our medalists come back with medals. Usually it's only boxing, maybe the odd scattered one here and there from other sports, but we usually rely on it from boxing. And yet if you go to a boxing international in the stadium within 6 months or a year after that, it may be less than a third full or a half full. If these guys, I think, were put on a show within a month of the Olympics, I think they could maybe fill a Croke Park type arena. You know, it's extraordinary.
Okay.
But I have the height of admiration for these fellas.
Did you ever give it a shot, Gary?
One time when I was about 12 up in Lockboy Community Hall in Kilkenny, and I went in for a fight with this guy who I could beat in the schoolyard, and he just walloped me straight in the nose. That was enough for me.
Well, your nose looks well for it. Right, we're going to open the programme with soccer. Shay Given was amongst our guests last night. You can listen back to him on the Game On podcast. He reassured us that he's been in Jack Grealish's ear about continuing his international career in the green of Ireland rather than switch allegiance to England, his country of birth. We will chat about the logistics of the granny rule and the tug of war between the associations and exactly where this 19-year-old stands in terms of potential international success. We made reference last night to the fact that Jack's father, Kevin, had been a guest on BBC Five Live, but he's on a farewell media tour himself, because this morning he was a guest of Alan Brazil on the UK radio station TalkSport.
My parents are Irish, Kerry and Galway, and my wife's father is Dublin.
Yeah.
And actually, I was born in Birmingham, like, and Jack was born in Solihull. That's where we're from, Solihull. And we just we played for Ireland at the age of 14, and we just went with the flow. But now everybody's talking a bit serious about it now, saying this and that, and what you're going to do, and you know. So it's, over the last few months, I've been asked the question loads and loads of times.
Well, Tim told us today. He says, "Look, you know, at the end of the day, let's hope Jack's playing that well that there is a tug of war." In fact, Kev, if you missed it, this is what Tim told us earlier on.
I had the same situation with Nabil Bentaleb. He could have gone to play for France. He decided to pick Algeria. And I did have a chat with him. He asked me, and I just said, you got to go with your heart. Do you think you're French or do you think you're Algerian? And that's the decision they need to make. And he decided to pick Algeria. Now, Jack needs to make that same decision.
Kev, I think that's great advice, don't you?
Yeah, that's fantastic, like, but you know, he's had a good game, he's had a few decent games recently, so he needs to just keep doing that first, and then, you know, his international stuff will come if he keeps performing, and he's got to do that first for the rest of the year, isn't he?
Kevin, the advice from Tim Sherwood, which is what I would tend to think is the most persuasive factor, which is where your emotion is, where your heart is. Could you see a situation where the head would rule the heart, or is it always going to be where the passion is?
It's going to be a difficult, you know, decision and everything. But at the moment, as I say, you know, it's completely up to Jack as well. Do you know what I mean?
I'm just going to say, is your missus going to put her handbag in here?
Yeah, she's always putting her handbag in it. I mean, there's a friendly coming up, isn't there, June the 7th? You know what I mean? So, you know, you never know. We could play 45 minutes for Ireland and 45 minutes for England. You know, half and half.
Costa Shaw is serious. Perhaps he's taken it. Brian is going to stay with us. We're joined as well from Manchester by a man whose Mayo roots, I know, would have him declaring for Ireland. Dominic McGuinness, how are you?
I'm very well, very well. Yeah, very interesting the way this one's all panning out. But, you know, I think that there's one of the interesting things, obviously, that he's only made 16 league starts for Villa, and it's all over the place here, and obviously in Ireland as well. And suddenly he's on the radar. This is a kid that's been playing for Ireland since he was 14. Suddenly he's on the radar. Now, suddenly there's almost an expectancy in some quarters that he declares for England. Well, again, obviously his father's keeping all the options open. But, you know, again, 16 starts in the league for Aston Villa. That's all that he's done so far. A kid of 19. So, you know, there's a lot of getting ahead of themselves on every side, I think, at the moment.
OK, first and foremost, Brian, in footballing terms, this guy, in your opinion, is the real deal. This is a guy that's worth fighting to get in the green jersey.
Yes, and I would say that was fairly obvious from a young age with him. I didn't see him until an under 21 match about 18 months ago, a friendly match against Portugal up in Tala. Against Holland. I don't think it was Holland's best team, but we won the match 3-0. I thought he was outstanding in the match, and I saw him in the game against Montenegro. And my instinct and my view then, and nothing has changed, was that he was the best attacking player I'd seen eligible to play for Ireland at 18 since Robbie Keane or Damien Duff. And I made that instant judgment, and I actually said it publicly within the last year, and I wondered, had I overcooked it a little bit? But having seen him I saw him for 25 minutes in the match against Arsenal earlier this year in October, and I was at the match with Spurs a couple of weeks back, and each time it just confirmed my opinion, and that my opinion was we needed to get him to declare for Ireland as soon as possible. Now, I qualify that by saying it's a very delicate issue. I had it in the past myself with some players. It's not easy. It's not simple. I was a bit strange, I thought, hearing his father referring to we, you know, played for Ireland since under 14. It sounds a bit like the Holy Ghost, two divine persons in one, but one of them is the one that runs out when the ball is on the ground. I found that all a bit odd, that type of comment, as if he was sharing in the glory of it. But this kid has played, as Dominic has said, since under 14 for Ireland. He scored a point in Croke Park playing for Warwickshire in a Gaelic match in 2008. It sounds like he's steeped in the Irish tradition. He's refused to play for England twice at underage level. Now the heat is really coming on. I just think it's a real pity that the business wasn't done by now. Mm. My view was we didn't need to wait until he played 18 matches for Aston Villa.
Dominic, to what extent do you think is he really on the radar for Roy Hodgson, or to what extent could he become a mainstay within the English international team?
Well, he could. He's caught the attention. He's had a great game in the Cup semi-final. You know, he looked fantastic. He's obviously got a really good attitude in terms of he's very sure of himself and he's exciting. You know, he's marketable. And that, and Brian's just hit the nail on the head. And this would be my only fear, is that if it is Team Grealish now that we're talking about, if it's going to be a brand that they're trying to develop, then where's the serious money? Well, if this kid is the real deal, and Brian is the best judge that we could have on tonight, if he is the real deal of someone that's come through the system and he's going to make a big name for himself, then maybe your Team Grealish is thinking there's more money to be made from constant European Championships, World Cups and England. And obviously there's been a fellow called David Beckham that has cleaned up. But what I would hope, and again, with his GAA background and with the fact that he's from a Birmingham community, and don't for one second think that all his Birmingham mates are telling him to play for England, because there'll be a lot of guys from the Birmingham Irish community that will be desperate for him to play for the Republic. For the reasons that we know about, his strong family roots and everything else, the fact that he obviously gets it. This isn't a mercenary, or you wouldn't have thought this is a kid that's just jumping ship because he can get an international senior call up for Ireland because everything else has run out. He's been involved in the Irish setup. And again, you know, he's a Villa lad. If you look at the Villa heroes, who are they? Paul McGrath's the biggest Villa hero by a mile. Dunn is a hero. Staunton's a hero. Houghton's a hero. You know, there are pressures from his own community in Birmingham that were wanting to pull on the green shirt. And so, when all's taken into account, Tim Sherwood's advice is probably the best. Where do you feel you should play? Forget all the nonsense about money or anything getting your head turned. He's 19 years of age. Look at the England squad. Look at Manchester City, if you like, for an example of an embarrassment of riches, of talent, and will you get a game? Look at England. Walcott, Wilshire. Now Harry Kane, he was a big talking point because of his Irish connection, but Harry had never gone through the system like obviously Jack has. So they're the things that you'd want him to take into consideration.
Does this bring you back, Brian, to Aidan McGeady, or are we back in a similar situation? Because that was one that probably caused more headaches than was required.
It's a little bit similar, but fortunately it didn't blow up the way this has as a result of the semi-final. Aidan was already in the setup and he was playing for Celtic. We'd had the tradition of Irish players playing for Celtic, particularly Paddy Bonner, who was the one who notified myself and Vincent Butler at the time about his eligibility when he was 15. But you think of the environment that Aidan McGeady was playing in when he broke through with Celtic. The ground is kind of a mass of tricolours and all that green and white stuff and so on. So I don't think it was such a difficult one for Aidan at the time. And there was probably a bit of continuity as well, in that he had played for me in the underage teams. Now I was the senior manager, but I did make a very conscious decision that I was going to get him into the senior setup as early as possible. I received some criticism actually that I didn't play him frequently enough when he was younger, you know, but the reality was, unlike Grealish, he wasn't strong. He was quite a skinny winger.
The wind had blown him over.
But we got there.
There's a text in here from Jay in Ulster. Martin O'Neill should go meet Grealish and his father and name him in the squad for the Scotland game. If the lad says no, good luck to him. Is it the responsibility of the senior manager to drive this now? And like, Martin O'Neill is great in press conferences, throws out great quips, but in black and white, my fear is some of those gags go over the head and they look a little bit close to the bone. And he's made a couple of jokes about it, but this is a serious situation. Does the manager need to pick up the phone, get on the flight, go to Birmingham, sort this out once and for all?
Well, it appears he thinks that that's not really his role. I would suggest it is. I mean, he has made comment in the past that there isn't enough talent coming through and ready-made players to improve the squad he had. The naked eye told me, and lots of other people that saw this player when he was younger, that he was special. So the manager should make the moves on it. You do have to eat a little bit of, you have to suppress your own ego and the standards and principles you might like to stick by to get the best to play for you sometimes. And I think, I agree with that, but I think it should have been done earlier. I think before the USA games in the summer would have been the right time to put it up to him. Now, I just feel that's an awful lot of pressure on the kid. Suddenly, because the attention, because of his performance in the Cup semi-final, that the whole fire has got a lot hotter. And I'm afraid, mention of Bentaleb and Dominic might correct me on this, I think Bentaleb played underage for France before he switched to Algeria for the World Cup. Now, I hope that's not a recipe for this situation.
Well, Dominic, before you go on, the flip side is like Andy O'Brien, okay, and I'm not trying to compare Andy O'Brien to Jack Grealish, but, you know, same thing, played underage for England. You had... who was it? John Macken played underage for England. You capped him. You gave him his debut for Ireland. Alan Kernaghan played underage for Northern Ireland. I know it's a different situation because the Good Friday Agreement changed eligibility rules. But a couple of texts in. Whatever country you play for at under 21 level, you should play for that country at senior level. Are there serious questions to be asked about international eligibility, Brian, and this, you know, mix and match and effectively international tourism in some cases?
I think it's got far too loose. I could understand the situation of players playing for a country at underage level up to under, say, 18 or 19, and then, you know, never really been good enough to play for them again, and having the eligibility for another country and taking that opportunity. But I don't get the one now where you know, where lads seem to be able to switch a match after 21.
Well, like Alex Bruce, two caps for the Republic, two caps for Northern Ireland at senior level. It's ludicrous.
I agree. Look, it happened with Di Stefano, you know, back a long time ago in the 50s, you know, Di Stefano played.
He was no Alex Bruce.
Yeah, no, but he didn't play for one country. He played for lots of different countries.
There's Jack Grealish on the phone now. Dominic, I'll give this to you. A couple of texts in the media. Sick of this Grealish malarkey. Put up or shut up. If he needs that long to commit, then let him sod off. The other one is, you clowns in there and the media. That's presumably me and Brian rather than you. But this guy has been big news.
Big red shoes on.
There you go. This guy's been big news in the UK all week, that he has dominated as many column inches since Sunday in the English editions of the papers as he has in the Irish editions.
Yeah, he has. It's been a huge talking point. And again, you know, it's not so long ago that a similar thing was happening with Harry Kane, as I mentioned earlier. And again, but because he's such an exciting player, and I think everything about him, he looks the part. I mentioned before, his marketability, and he's just captured the imagination. And I think it's as much about his attitude. And you've got to remember that, you know, people still talk about Paul Gascoigne, you know, that natural arrogance, that natural flair, that, you know, in a number 10 position, if you like, in terms of that exciting style of play that he seems to have. That's why, again, as Brian said, and many people would have commented, that it's not been put to bed yet. It's still out there for people to talk about, which does put pressure on him. And I'm sure his head is absolutely spinning at the moment. But, you know, I'm sure there are people that really he should be speaking to. Ray Houghton has been vocal about this situation. And there are others that maybe have gone the other way. If you think back in time to Noel Whelan, Kevin Gallen, who ended up playing England 21s and couldn't switch, couldn't change, and they'd committed, they'd declared that way. I'm sure if hindsight, they'd probably say, well, did I do the right thing? Even the likes of Aaron Lennon, who apparently, you know, could have been eligible. And plays, he wants to think, and with his strong, strong ties, it's a crazy one. But I think, again, to remember his age, to remember his experience, and also to remember overhyped players. I mean, who replaced him at the cup semi-final at the weekend? Joe Cole. Now, Joe Cole was the most hyped kid that existed, you know, going back 15, 20 years, whatever it was. So
I was going to say, it's only a matter of time before there's a story in the papers about himself and Roy not getting on when Roy was assistant manager at Villa. Gary, you want to jump in?
Like, there's two things. Obviously, there's a big issue with his dad. His dad is, as Brian said, saying we. Huge problem. Get out of your kid's career and let him have his own. And the other one is, how has Roy Keane missed this kid if he's that good?
But who says he did?
But if he is that good, potentially that good, you just give the kid a cap and that's it, done. Get him started. He should never have missed that if he's that talented. Why would someone like Roy Keane... Now, he's the assistant manager.
I understand Martin went to see him at Notts County and he didn't play in the match. He was dropped, right? Now, I don't know how often he's actually seen him. Like, just as an instant, Martin, you know, I think he's gone to two League of Ireland matches since he's been the manager. I hope he goes to see these key players. If there's someone in the underage setup, tell them. In Trapattoni's time, they would have missed things. He wasn't interested. Neither was Tardelli. Are they just depending on the views of Noel King, Paul Doolan, Tom Moan to tell them? But when someone tells you there's something special, we don't have that depth of talent that
exactly.
We have.
Okay.
We only produce someone special every few years.
Yeah, and maybe, well then, we could have another philosophical debate some other day about Rude Doctor and the technical department and if pathways and everything else, but we'll leave that for another day when this resolves itself. Dominic, good to talk to you as always. Thanks for joining us.
All the best, fellas.
Dominic McInnes there from Manchester. Final text. The manager has to listen and get his act together. Go meet him. Ask him and get answers. Yes, no. And see where to go from there. Maybe the conversation has happened and it'll all be as clear as mud in September. Brian, good to see you as always.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for your time. Gary's going to stay with us. Much more to come. We'll be chatting Champions League after the break.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
And you're most welcome back to the programme. 51552 for your text at Game on 2FM. For your tweets, opinions, good, bad or indifferent on Jack Grealish and everything else. More than welcome. Louise McSharry, it's great to see you.
You too.
Long time no speak.
I know, right?
Yeah, it's good to see you. You're welcome back. Do you think Jack Grealish should declare for the Republic of Ireland or England?
I think he should absolutely declare for the Republic of Ireland.
There you go. That's the final word. Louise has spoken. Jack, if you're listening, done deal. What wonders do you have for us after 8 o'clock?
Well, the show has changed a little bit since I've been off. We've decided to make it just all about the music. So we're just jam-packed with tunes, basically, but it's all new music. So it's stuff that you might not have heard before. So tonight we've got new stuff from Chance the Rapper. We have got the newest one from Rihanna. There is some new music from Mo and Diplo. It's all very cool, Damon. Okay. You wouldn't understand.
I'm too old for all this. I'm like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon. I'm too old for this. You know what?
Excuse me, I recognise the Rihanna, all the rest.
Yeah, Rihanna, yeah. Yeah,
I threw Rihanna in there just so that you'd have something to cling on to.
Keep us upright. Yeah.
Have you ever played a record from Frozen, the Frozen soundtrack?
Never.
That's where my life is at the moment.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I respect that.
I feel your pain.
Let it go.
The great thing about being in Augusta last week was I didn't get to see cartoons for the week.
You missed it, really. Louise is here after 8 o'clock. Wow. We are but your warm-up act.
No offence, but you sound like you've given up, you two.
We have. My young one's 3. I have 15 more years before I can disown her, so that's where my life is at. Anyway.
Positivity.
Thanks, good luck. Louise is here after 8 o'clock. Champions League evening, 7:45 starts between Barcelona and PSG. Barcelona 3-1 up. Bayern Munich trail FC Porto by the same scoreline. They meet at the Allianz Arena this evening. That was probably the standout result for most people last week. Porto beating Munich. The fallout has been pretty extensive. Most notably, Pep Guardiola's apparent sacking of Hans-Willem Müller-Wohlfahrt, who had acted as Bayern Munich's club doctor for 38 years.
Easy for you to say.
Easy for me. He's the guy who, like, Michael owns knees and he injects you with placentas and all sorts of stuff. He's been Bayern Munich's doctor since 1977 until he got the bullet last week. He was effectively blamed for all the injuries and the defeat. Let's look ahead to that game. We'll get a view from Raphael Honigstein, a regular contributor of ours on German football. The defeat, the sacking, the backlash from former players, Pep's future has been questioned. A pretty bad week in Bavaria.
It has been, of course. You know, whenever Bayern lose, it's a big story. When they lose in the Champions League, the one title that they really want to win or have to win under Guardiola, it is a very big story because they define the whole season by what happens in the Champions League. So, of course, the pressure is enormous on him. And with the doctor resigning after that game, of course, it created a huge media frenzy and an unbelievable story. And, you know, people have portrayed it as a power struggle here. You've got Müller-Wohlfahrt, the iconic figure who's been on the bench there for nearly 40 years, and Pep Guardiola, who has got a fantastic reputation but still hasn't quite delivered yet. Now, the truth is actually slightly less exciting because Bayern, despite wanting and having to get into the semi-finals, actually feel that Guardiola is the best possible coach they've got right now. And he is, if anything, under less pressure than he was a year ago. When he'd come into a team that just won the treble, everybody expected him to sweep Europe before them yet again, and they were humiliated by Real Madrid, and there was a huge, huge embarrassment. The situation is different now. Whatever happens tonight will, of course, reflect on his international standing, but internally, as far as the club concerns, they will remain very happy for him, and there's absolutely no way they'll try and get rid of him for next season.
Well, to put next season to bed, because when he spoke at his press conference earlier this week, he quite pointedly talked about his plans for Wednesday and his plans for Thursday and talked about wanting to be there. Is there any possibility that he himself would walk away? Or, as we stand, is there no doubt in your mind that he will be the manager of Bayern despite the possible lure of Manchester City?
Yeah, well, I mean, the only possibility that has been mentioned to me from people who are close to the club is in effect a good one, because they think, well, if they were to win the treble, maybe he'll say, you know what else can I do next season? But I think, A, that's remote. B, even if it were to happen, I think he'd be very careful not to walk out of a job after 2 years, because you don't want to be the sort of manager that signs very short-term deals and then doesn't even stick to those. So the assumption in Munich is that he will fulfill his contract come what may. He will not be fired. If anything, they'll try very, very hard to renew the contract. I don't think he will, because I think he will need another challenge after winning everything domestically. I can see them winning the double again this year. But the Champions League, of course, is the one they want and the one the club want. And, of course, getting knocked out in the quarters against Porto will be seen as a disappointment and as failure.
And when you consider that they've been in four of the last five semi-finals, three of the last five finals, and they've a couple of final successes to throw in there as well, would it be seen as a failure by the top brass within the club were they not to advance to the semi-finals, finals, or possibly win the Champions League?
Yes, it would be seen as failure, because they set out to do that. They set out to at least get into the semi-final. They feel that they've got now, you know, the best Bayern team ever, certainly a Bayern team good enough to win the Champions League. And you don't know, with football changing quickly and also this team coming to the end of its natural cycle. You know, you think of the big players, they're all over 30. Schweinsteiger, Ribery, Robben, Lahm. They've only got one, maybe 2 years left in them. So you have to almost win it now with Guardiola, because A, they don't know how long these players will last, and B, they also don't know how long they've got Guardiola. And the problem is that there is no one on the horizon now that Thomas Tuchel has gone to Dortmund who they can even think of as a natural replacement. So that's just another reason why actually the pressure on him isn't that big, because there's no one in Bayern's mind who is as good as he is.
Just before we talk about the game itself, the fact that Franz Beckenbauer has come out so publicly about, like, Dante in particular after last week's performance, and, you know, referring to it effectively as a night of shame, and Stefan Effenberg over the weekend urging the club not to give Guardiola too much power. Is he the pawn in a massive political and power struggle that's going on, featuring all these former heroes of the club in the gulf left by Ole Hoeneß?
Not really. I mean, Franz Beckenbauer is no longer involved in the club. Stefan Effenberg is not involved at all in the club. They are in the media in the role as pundits. And people take their opinions on board, and they make big headlines, especially with Beckenbauer. But also, if you're in Munich and you know Beckenbauer for the last few years, he changes his tune every 5 minutes. So if Bayern were to win now, you know, he will call Guardiola the best coach ever, and will even forget Jupp Heynckes' name. So these things look very dramatic and like a game of thrones and a big power struggle. But actually, the people who have the real power in the club right now, in Karl-Heinz Rummenigge most of all, and one or two other players, they absolutely love what Guardiola does. And nothing that will happen tonight, bar some catastrophic, you know, 5-0 defeat, which I can't foresee, will change that. So it's a bit like Mourinho Chelsea. You know, he got knocked out twice in the Champions League. In other times, he would have said, you know, that's unforgivable. But his standing is so secure in the club that it's no longer defined by one game in the Champions League. So the same is true of Guardiola this time around.
And in his press conferences of late, he has been remarkably open and honest about how difficult he has found the last couple of weeks and months at Munich, and nearly going as far to say it's more difficult than any challenge he faced at Barcelona.
Yes, but that's down to the injuries.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have your key difference makers in attack, if you don't have Robin, Ribery, Alaba, Schweinsteiger's been injured, the kind of guys who A, perform on the big nights, and B, make the difference, especially against very defensive teams, Bayern have struggled to open up teams. And what happened to Porto was, not only were they missing big players, not only were they making terrible individual mistakes at the back, I mean, catastrophic mistakes that even the best coach in the world, I think, can't foresee, but also, thirdly, too many of the other big players who were on the pitch had just come back from big injuries, didn't look quite fit, or in the case of Xabi Alonso, just look very, very tired. The guy's played too many games, it's caught up with him, and the Xabi Alonso that got the fantastic plaudits at the beginning of the season now is being seen as something of a liability. But he's just played too many games.
Do you give them any chance of progressing to the semi-finals?
Well, their chance is very good. A 2-0 at home, is, as Thomas Müller in his typical style said, wouldn't be the greatest world miracle in football. At the same time, you feel that they need to have kind of the perfect game. And at the moment, looking at the team with all the problems we just talked about, you don't really see them, or I don't quite see them putting in that perfect game. Can they beat Porto 2-0? Yes, of course. But I can just as well foresee them beating Porto only 1-0 a 2-1, and then everybody turning around and doing the thing that you hear so often in knockout football and saying, you know what, we didn't lose it tonight, we lost it last week in Porto. That is my fear from a German perspective, that it didn't do quite enough last week to give themselves a much better chance this time around.
Okay, Rafa, enjoy the game. Thanks for your time as always.
Thank you.
Let's chat more about the Champions League games. Raphael Honigstein, slightly optimistic that Bayern could advance. Mark Langan of the Racing Post is with us as always on Tuesdays. Mark, how are you?
Hello, Damien. Yeah, I'm good. Yourself?
Not too bad at all. In a word, Munich or Porto to advance to the semi-finals?
Bayern Munich. Very confident, actually.
Okay, there. Well, you go along with Rafa. Barcelona, PSG. Ibra back tonight, but realistically, you would put your mortgage, I'm sure, on Barca surviving.
Yeah, Rafa just mentioned there about the damage done in the first leg. I mean, that was nothing compared to the damage done for PSG in terms of their first leg performance, really. They were just too timid and too intimidated by Barcelona without Ibrahimovic, without Thiago Motta, without Verratti. Thiago Silva got injured very early on in that game. Luis came on and, you know, he was slaughtered by everybody, you know, for what Luis Suarez did to him in that game in terms of really destroying him. But Luis was only sort of 50% fit at absolute best. He shouldn't really have been on the pitch. And you know, Laurent Blanc will look back on that first leg and just wish he would have had all of these players available, because I'm sure that they were capable of giving Barcelona a much better game. But I've got, you know, it's hard enough going to the Nou Camp at 0-0, never mind 3-1 down.
Okay, Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid. Real suffering badly with injuries, but still probably going to be the tie of the round.
Yeah, I think that Atletico were probably the more satisfied, actually, with that 0-0. They'll really fancy their chances. Of course, they've played Real 7 times now this season. Real Madrid still haven't beaten them. There's no Modric, there's no Bale, there's no Benzema. I think Atletico will score in the Bernabeu, and one goal could be enough with their excellent defence.
Okay, and then Monaco and Juve. Again, Juve home record put them in good stead last week. Can Monaco create history?
I don't think that Monaco are good enough to score, you know, the two goals that they're going to need to win the tie without the need for penalties. And I think on the break, as Juventus showed in the previous round against Borussia Dortmund, they're absolutely lethal on the counter-attack. And I think Juve can score in Monaco, and one goal should be enough for them to make it through to the semi-finals.
OK, we'll wait and see. Mark, good to talk to you as always. Thanks for joining
us. Damien.
Mark Langdon there, the Madrid Derby live on RT2 television. Tomorrow evening, to celebrate betting on the move with the Boyle Sports mobile app, we're going to give one lucky listener the chance to win a VIP day out at the Boyle Sports Champion Chase Day at Punchestown on Tuesday the 28th of April. The winner and a friend will be treated to a 4-star overnight accommodation, VIP hospitality passes and €500 spending money. Not just that, but between now and Friday, we're going to give 5 daily winners 2 tickets each to the Boyle Sports Champion Chase Day at Punchestown on Tuesday the 28th. On Friday, we'll put the 20 names into the hat, pick one lucky winner to upgrade the racing day out to include that overnight accommodation, VIP hospitality and €500 spending money. All you have to do to identify, to win that, is to identify this Premier League manager.
You have to prepare yourself every week for every game in the weekend.
Okay, will we go again?
You have to prepare yourself every week for every game in the weekend.
Okay.
I can win that.
You can win that.
Definitely.
Okay.
He's good at free kicks back in the day.
Well done. He also manages the club, which, when you put their spending into the league table, have the best return per euro spent. So anyway, I'll give it to you one more time.
You have to prepare yourself every week for every game in the weekend.
We've got Paddy Barnes, Michael Conlon coming up in 30 seconds.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
This is the part of the programme I've been looking forward to most, but no offence to Gary Murphy or to Brian or to anyone else who's been on. Two more names have been confirmed for the Irish team for next summer's Rio Olympic Games, and two very strong medal hopes securing their place on the plane over the weekend. Michael Conlon, good evening to you.
How's it going?
Good to talk to you. Paddy Barnes, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you?
Good. I'm in good form. It's great to talk to the two of you. Thank you very much for your time. And Paddy, I suppose to yourself, I'm sure there was never a doubt in your mind that you'd be going to Rio, that it was always going to be a case of when rather than if you'd qualify.
Yeah, it was always a case of when. But, you know, I knew, obviously, it's Olympic Games and the qualifying process is extremely hard. So I knew it was going to be tough. I'm just glad that pick out of the line so early.
Michael, you'd echo that as well. And I suppose the World Series of Boxing, it's done great things to give you extra fights and more competitive fights. But has it made qualifying for the Olympics an even bigger task?
Yeah, it's made it a bigger task. You know, we fought there 7 times in 14 weeks. It was a very, very tough competition, as you've seen throughout each week. And to get there through WSB and get the qualification over and done with a year to go, it's fantastic for both of us.
And from your point of view, Michael, was it a tenser weekend for you? Because Paddy obviously knew that a win would get him over the line, whereas you were forced to wait and see how other bouts went.
Yeah, it was very tough for me. You know, I knew Paddy was a certain. I just wanted to make sure after I found out I wasn't going to qualify. I just wanted to make sure Paddy was qualifying, and I was gutted, but I knew he had to go and do the job, and I was confident he would. So my heart was in my mouth for me losing, but also for him going into the ring, having to try to qualify. I was getting in with no nerves, nothing on my shoulders. You know, I didn't have a clue if I was going to qualify or not. So when I went in and I qualified, it made everything even better.
Paddy, I know from interviewing the two of you and the other boxers in London after the bouts last time around that you really are the team within the team, that you all push each other on so much. So I suppose yourself and Michael now have shown everyone that qualification is up and running, and you'll hope that you motivate the rest to get the skids on and get Rio bound as well.
Yeah, well, I think both of us have got the ball rolling, you know. And in just another few weeks, we'll have Joe Ward and David Oliver-Joyce. They're fighting in the APB, so they have their chance to qualify pretty soon too. So, and then obviously you've got the European Games in June, which is a qualifier for the Worlds. So, you know, Irish boxing and I are going to be looking forward to trying to up their game and qualify as much boxers as they can.
Yeah, and undoubtedly, Paddy, you're going for gold. You're there to win, aren't you?
Of course, you know, I wouldn't, you know, this sport's just too tough. The training's too tough. The sacrifices you make are too tough, you know, just to go over and take part. You know, if I didn't think or didn't blame myself that I have a realistic chance of winning gold, you know, I would slack in training, you know what I mean? So I am going there for gold. You know, I feel my best. If I perform my best, I could win gold. So that makes me train even harder.
And Michael, I remember chatting to you after the winning the bronze medal, and I couldn't get over how open you were about disappointment, and you talked straight away about having felt that you'd let people down, which I know, like to come home with a medal was a phenomenal achievement. But do you think you'll be a much better boxer in Rio next year for the experience of having gone through London?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think I'm coming into my prime in the amateur career now. I'll be 24 going to Rio, and I'll be a fully developed man. Last time I was only a boy going to London. They came away with bronze, you know, and I was very immature in my fighting. And now I'm a lot stronger. I'm a lot bigger. I'm up a weight division, and I feel it's helped me in my strength tenfold. So going to Rio, I know I'm going to go there, and I know I'm going to win gold. It's not about thinking about it. I know I'm going to win gold. I know I'm going to put a proper preparation in for it. So I'll be coming back from gold with Rio.
And when you go there with that level of self-confidence and justified belief, does it take the pressure off you? Because between now and Rio, idiots like me are going to talk about the boxers winning medals time and time again, but you believe you're going to do it irrespective of what anyone says.
Yeah, but anybody, it doesn't matter what anybody says. It's what I've done and what I do in training. Who I train with is what gives me the belief. You know, the things we do in training, me and Paddy, we push ourselves beyond belief, and I think we train harder than anybody in the world, and that's not just, I'm not just saying that because he's on the phone as well, but I really do believe it.
Okay. Okay.
We do some amount of training, so it's crazy.
Brilliant. Paddy, to finish, Kenny Egan was on the programme a couple of weeks ago, and he kind of half suggested that if you got to your third Olympics, you'd probably have eclipsed him as Ireland's greatest amateur boxer, so you've got bragging rights over Big Kenneth at this stage.
Well, there is a lot of slagging on between me and Kenny. You know, he'd always point the finger saying he's number one and all, you know, because he's got the Olympic silver medal. But in fairness, you know, he is one of the greatest ever. He has records that probably will never be broke. Regards, you know, Irish senior champion 10 times in a row, you know, I can't see anybody ever doing that. And obviously his Olympic silver medal in Beijing, where I thought he should have won gold. So, you know, he's a legend himself.
Okay. Lads, I appreciate your time. I, you know, fair play to him. I'm delighted for the two of you personally and for the Olympic team and everything. It's great news, and we'll chat no doubt between now and Rio. Thanks for taking the call.
No problem.
That's great. Michael Conlon and Paddy Barnes joining us there. Two great characters, but hard work at the back of it all.
Absolutely. And boxing is such a, I wouldn't say a horrendous sport, but it's so penal, really. You know, the effort they put in and what they put their bodies and minds through. And wonderful to see them going to Rio. Hopefully a couple of goals.
And a fellow Northern Ireland man, Mark Allen, 8-3 up on Ryan Day at the World Snooker Championship. So Northern Ireland, it's all about the North, you know. They're flying the flag for the rest of us, so the pressure's on.
All about Ireland, Damien.
Everyone down here. That's it, it's all the same.
All the one village.
We're going to talk athletics of sort next. The 2015 staging of the Marathon Amateurs Running Race celebrating the Day of the Sun, or the Pyongyang Marathon in Old Money, took place last weekend. And it might surprise a lot of people that for the country of North Korea, the race is becoming a big attraction for tourists. But what is it like to race in the capital of what people might consider to be one of the more secluded countries in the world? Well, one man who has done just that is Jerry Longman of the New York Times, who's with us. Jerry, how are you?
Good to be with you.
Good to talk to you again. We've chatted in the past about Arsenal Football Club's ownership and various levels of American sport. It surprised me when I saw your article about having run in the North Korean Marathon. How did it come to pass?
Well, last year the North Koreans opened their Pyongyang Marathon up to Westerners. You know, the government is lacking for money. They need hard currency. So I think that's the main reason they let runners in. So they did it again this year. So I signed up with a tour group out of Beijing run by Brits. And, 650 runners from 30 nations were allowed in. To see, as you say, sort of a brief opening into the most closed society in the world. So I figured, well, I couldn't pass that up.
How difficult is it for a man who writes for the, probably the most circulated metropolitan newspaper in the United States to be allowed entry to North Korea? Or is it simply a case if you've got dollars in your back pocket, you can get in no problem?
Yeah, I was upfront about who I was. So apparently, you just need dollars, I guess.
Okay, simple as. Overall, I don't want to say how strange an experience is it to be in North Korea, because it's slightly insulting to the people that are there, but is it the novelty, even that's a worse word to use, I'll ask this in the most simplest terms. What is it like to go to North Korea and wander around a city that most of us will never get the opportunity to walk around?
So, it's a military-first society. Their entire structure is built on the military-first. So you go to a children's playground and you'll see a children's slide next to a small missile replica. And the cult of personality of the Kim family, the ruling family, is so pervasive that, they even have flowers named after them, the Kim Il-sungia, the Kim Jong-ilia. And their enmity towards the United States is obvious. They have the captured American ship from 1968 on display, and at their National War Museum, there's a diorama of the Korean War that shows a dead American soldier being preyed on by a crow and a vulture. So that militaristic side is there and pervasive. But when you get on the streets and you start running, you get away from your minders and you can't really leave the course, but you get to see people with, having spontaneous reactions, soldiers high-fiving the runners, little children slapping hands with you, speaking to you in English, saying, welcome to Korea, how are you, nice to meet you. So, you do get some spontaneous reactions, and it's always important, I think, to sort of distinguish between the dignity of the people and the militarism of the government.
Mm. There's a line or towards the tail end of the article that you've written on the New York Times website, which is available for people to read over this side of the Atlantic. We think of North Korea, we think of orchestrated events, orchestrated occurrences, Kim Jong-un getting 5 holes in 1 on his round of golf and all that sort of stuff. Was there any element of the marathon being used for political means or for public relation means?
Well, there's a sense, I think there are several reasons that our guides and North Korean guides and our British guides told us they need hard currency. And they want to introduce more mass sport, sport to the society. So we saw, you know, there are many more, like, say, basketball courts and things like that. Mm. And thirdly, obviously, you know, they have this reputation for being militaristic and for human rights abuses. I mean, the United Nations in 2013, you know, accused them of having, you know, the prisoner camps, forced starvation, torture. So I think surely in some ways they must be trying to sort of ameliorate that with by opening up their country, you know, a small bit to foreigners.
And it would appear that sport and the arts, particularly film festivals, look like being the way that they will try and open the doors of North Korea to the world.
Yeah, they have an international film festival, and, you know, people I think are already signing up for the 2016 Pyongyang Marathon. But, you know, whether this is going to work as far as bringing in enough tourism and that kind of thing, you know, there are a lot of people who doubt it. I was reading a book by a Russian expert on North Korea who says that, you know, this just will never work. They just don't have the infrastructure. Okay. For instance, they have a 105-story hotel in the middle of downtown Pyongyang, and they've been building it since 1987. It's still just a shell. It's empty, and no one's in it. So, you know, it's hard to tell.
Okay. And I'm interested. They have an Arc de Triomphe, which is bigger than the one in Paris, which, you know, they'll take great pride in. But if you want to use the bathroom during the marathon, you effectively have to run into a business or someone's home. So
yeah,
the logistics could do with some improving.
There are no, you know, portable toilets. I'd like to have the portable toilet concession in North Korea. They have none. So you run off the course into, you know, off the course into a, you know, second story of a building, or one of them. I didn't go into this one, but one of the runners said that one of them was you had to go through a shop, a restaurant, and a karaoke bar, and you finally got to the restaurant. And then last year, some guy just ran into all the bathrooms just to see them, because, you know, when else would you ever get a chance to go into these buildings?
Indeed. It's a great story, Jerry. Appreciate your time. Thanks for telling it. And people can follow your work. And I know you're on Twitter, and they can read about your experience on the New York Times website. Good to talk to you again. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Jerry Longman joining us there. Have you ever considered running a marathon anywhere, Gary, rather than the North Korean marathon?
No, it wouldn't be on my bucket list, I have to say.
Yeah, nor mine.
It's tiring watching a marathon, never mind running one.
There you go. Yeah, 26.2 miles, as I've educated Al Porter on numerous occasions this week. The winners of our Boyle Sports mobile app competition, The Voice, was this one.
You have to prepare yourself every week for every game in the weekend.
And he is?
Ronald Koeman.
Well done. Jack Griffin in Waterford, Evan O'Dwyer, Dermot Finnegan in Dundalk, Ken Cameron and John Jordan. I want to briefly get your opinion or get your view. People that follow Irish golf journalism will know Brian Keogh. He's got an interesting article on his website this week about eligibility of Irish golfers to play in the Irish Open. And it touches upon something that you brought up last week, that guys who should be getting a great crack off playing the National Open can't because of the structure of the tournament.
Well, yeah, there's a big debate at the moment. There's six PGA guys playing. Niall Carney won the Order of Merit last year. Michael McGeady and Colin Moriarty. But they're not club professionals, so they're not entitled to be part of the first six. So it's gone down to number nine. And you see the quality of the field this year. I think it's... I've always been of the opinion that there's too many PGA guys getting in. When we have a situation where Peter Lawrie, Simon Thornton, and Gareth Maven are probably going to struggle for invites. Peter will probably get one, but I think we need to go more in a world ranking system of Irish guys,
okay,
rather than a lot of club pros playing.
Give me a couple of guys to have a look out for this week on the European or PGA Tour, if off the top of your head.
Justin Rose will do well in New Orleans. Steve Stricker is a good tip. Grillo in China. And I think Scott Hend will go very close in China. And Westwood's in Indonesia should win there.
You're off to do a week's hard work now on the Chinese event, so we wish you well. We will chat when we chat again. Gary Murphy has been with us over the course of the programme. Last text of the evening goes to Owen. Did Kim Jong-un win the marathon even though he didn't run in it? You're going to have to read Jerry Longman's article on the New York Times website to find out. Louise McSharry is on the way after 8 o'clock. The lovely Kira and your man Chris are here after 10. He's not even listening. He's outside the window swigging a bottle of Coke. Thanks to JJ. Thanks to Andrew O'Connor. From Damien O'Mara, till we chat again. Good night.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight-talking savings bank.